they chose to finally leave before they were thrown out. They're elderly. Another 5 years will retire Mr. Hicks from farming, period. I mean, it makes all the difference in his life. And they won't grant him that extra time. And the tragedy of it is the land will just sit there. Nothing happens to it, except it's allowed to grow up. Where now, as long as Johnny's cutting the hay and planting crops, it encourages the wildlife. So the DNR will want the people out, the land will grow up, then they'll have to hire bulldozers to come in and brush hogs to clear the land and plant food for the deer population. And that's happened in Braxton County. That it's taken a lot of money to make the area the way it was when they made the people leave. That's a tragedy. I was real concerned when John Probaugh called the U.S. attorney. That was the first thing he said. Well, she got her money, you know. And she says she didn't get her money. I was afraid that, you know, maybe something wrong was going on. And, of course, as soon as she told me that she would lose her pension, I said the same thing everybody else said. You know, I can't believe that you would lose your pension, you know, because you were forced to sell your home and got that money. But it's absolutely true. She received a letter. Yesterday she said she lost it.
Did the Corps know she was getting that pension?
Yeah, she explained that at some point to the Corps. And,
do you think they could have had any hand in alerting the...
I'm not sure if they did or if it was... publicity. You see, I mean, Barbara kept saying, I don't have any money. If she hadn't said that, then it wouldn't have become such an issue. And it wouldn't have become an issue if Ron Donnell hadn't tried to cover his rear end, you know, by thinking, well, here, she was frauded or something by her attorney, and now I'm going to be the hero in this thing. That's why the whole thing became so public.
Cake to your mommy.
But I think really, I really believe that she kept hoping all along, and other people have, that the project would be stopped. The money would be there, you know, she could just give them back their money and that would be the end of it. And that's the way we wrote the deauthorizing bill. That anybody that was in condemnation at the time, I mean, the whole thing was just simply dropped and the title to their land was returned to the owner, to the original owner.
Well, so, what happened on October 23rd?
Civil rights were suspended in Lewis County. I was, when you deal with the Corps after a while, you get sort of paranoid. And so many things happen. And you're not sure how much of it's coincidence and how much of it the Corps orchestrates. Because I've learned in the last, 7 or 8 years of this damn fight that there isn't anything that they wouldn't do to achieve their goals. If it's pitting neighbor against neighbor, brother against brother, anything they can do, they'll do. They have absolutely no scruples. And moral considerations don't enter into anything. I will say that the fellow that was in charge on the local level was much more considerate than this new fellow. A lot of this is coming because Klein, who's down there now, just won't cut the landowner a break, period.
John Klein.
Mm-hmm. He's just been really hostile. I was in Huntington. My mother had had surgery for cancer, and I had gone down there for the weekend, and... on Tuesday, then, I was kind of planning to come home Tuesday evening anyway, but late Tuesday, my son called me and told me that they had evicted Barbara and Bobby in chains, and I couldn't believe it. because I thought that we had a guarantee from them that they wouldn't do just that thing. So I came home and started calling around to find out exactly what had happened and pieced the story together the best I could. And I talked to the sheriff's office, and I talked to Barbara's relatives and the watershed people that were trying to get her things out. And basically what happened was Barbara and Bobby had gotten up that morning late. And Barbara said she'd gone down and put a pot of coffee on the stove. Maybe she's told all this to you. You want me to? Well, anyway, she'd put a pot of coffee on the stove and became aware then that someone was there. There was a knock on the door. She answered it, and it turned out to be the federal marshals. Bobby's main concern at the time was simply for his dog, because Donnell had told him before, at least Bobby understood, that the dog would be destroyed. And Bobby was afraid that they were going to kill his dog. The first thing Donnell did was to come through and cut the telephone cord. That was his first act, so that they couldn't call for help. Bobby then kept saying, "You're not going to kill my dog. You're not going to kill my dog." One of the marshals pushed him down in a chair then, and he just stood up and he punched the guy in the shoulder. And, you know, he's not the world's heaviest set young fella, and the federal marshal wasn't the world's largest federal marshal, but you could never possibly look at these two people and see them as any kind of a violent threat. You just couldn't do it.
I came down here day before yesterday preparing myself for what Bobby would look like. I thought, after what I had, how I had heard these marshals treated him, that he must be a demented-looking, very threatening-looking person.
Yeah.
Maybe very feeble-minded and with a sort of a dangerous posture about him. But that's not what I found.
No, and they had 3 guns in that house, Mike. They had rifles and they had shotguns. And if they were going to be violent, those federal marshals wouldn't have gotten to the doorstep. And if it hadn't been for him scaring Bobby about his dog, Bobby wouldn't have gotten, quote, violent. He wouldn't have taken a swing at him. It's probably the only person Bob Hevener has ever hit in his entire life.
Can you tell me a little bit more about Bob, what you know of him?
Yeah, he's 23, and he's just got real close ties to home. Partly because his father's dead and his mother depends on him. But you never hear Bobby without Barbara, or Barbara without Bobby. Barbara belongs to my home demonstration club, and Bobby belongs to our home demonstration club. And they go everywhere together, and they do everything together. I mean, they're never separated, hardly. Bobby did work at, last summer, maybe the summer before, he worked on that summer youth project. And then he did leave Barbara and work out like that during the summer. But he's just extremely dependent on her. And I don't know how to say this without, you know, I don't want to be denigrating to him. So I'll just leave it up to you to do it. And use it however you, I mean, I know how you feel about the same situation, labeling people and stuff. But Bobby isn't able to live out on his own by himself. He doesn't drive a car. He had an accident and he was physically hurt, so he's not real strong. He's not strong physically and he's not strong mentally. But because they lived in a community and everybody knows Barbara and Bobby, you know, they were able to get along just great. And she had her regular customers, you know, people that came and dealt with her year after year. She had her regular markets where she, you know, could market her stuff. And Bobby was real involved with FFA in school, and he was in a VOAG program and did extremely well in it. And so they were really competent. If you took Barbara and Bobby Hevener and put them in downtown Charleston to live somewhere, people would think that they were strange. But they're not strange you know, they're not that strange around here. Everybody knows their limitations and their, you know, idiosyncrasies, and you just take that into account, you know, when you're dealing with them. Barbara can't drive at night, and so, you know, in order to get to meetings and things at night, she'd ride with my family. And so you just made sure that Barbara got a ride, if, you know, if it was something to do with the watershed or whatever.
How would you describe the way Bobby looks? What does he look like?
Who is it, Michael, that does these, the prints of the farmer and his wife standing there holding a pitchfork? You know who I'm, that American Gothic?
Uh-huh.
That's Bobby Havner. He's tall, but he's
a rural Gothic person.
Absolutely. He's tall, but he's real thin. And long-legged and long-jointed. He talks a lot like that Festus character on the old Andy Griffith show. You know, he's got that kind of a speech. But you can't find anybody clearer on dates and details than those two. They've got remarkable memories. I mean, Barbara can tell you what the weather was like on a specific day of a year. I mean, they're really incredible when it comes to those kinds of details. You just couldn't look at this kid and visualize him as any kind of a violent threat. I mean, and had they not provoked him as badly as they did, he would never have done anything, I don't believe. But I mean, he was worried about his dog because they thought he was going to kill their, you know, he thought the marshals were going to kill his dog, and that's what he was the most concerned about at that time. Barbara told me, you know, they wrestled him to the ground and put the handcuffs on him and a chain around his waist. And she said they told him that he had to kneel. They wanted him to sit there and kneel, and he's got a bad leg, and he told him he couldn't do that, and they just wouldn't listen. But I saw him afterwards, and he had bruises up and down both arms, and he had a black eye. Then it's ludicrous to think of them putting chains and handcuffs on Bobby, but to think of them doing it to Barbara, I mean, she couldn't weigh more than 110 pounds. I don't believe. And there were three of them. There were two men and a woman. There was a matron there. And coming through Weston on their way, Federal Marshal Greenaway told me that he finally talked Donnell into calling the state police. Donnell refused to call the sheriff's office. And he finally talked him into calling the state police. But they didn't bother to wait till the state police got there to do anything. By the time the state police got there, they had already done, you know.
Donnell was directing the raid.
Right. The raid. Yeah. The eviction. Hey, he's the head marshal or whatever. Anyway, this is Greenaway's boss. And, of course, Greenaway tried to make out like he didn't approve of the way the whole thing was handled. You know, and he admitted that to me. And I asked him flat out, I said, well, how did the telephone cord get cut? And he said, I don't know. He said, Mrs. Havner asked me, she told me that she wanted to call her attorney, and I went in to check out the telephone. And I said, well, why did you feel the necessity to check out the telephone if you didn't think something had happened to it? I mean, obviously it was her phone, she knew it was in working order. And he said, well, I had to check to make sure there weren't scissors or a knife or some weapon that they could use to hurt us. And I said, I think that's ludicrous. They searched their clothing. They treated them just like some kind of a murder criminals. They told them they were under arrest, but didn't tell them what they were under arrest for. They just came in and said, you're under arrest. We know a fellow up in Upshur County who's Yugoslavian. He was a freedom fighter during the war, fought with the underground. And he was telling my husband, he said, this is the way it happened there. This is just the kind of thing that they do there. You know, they use unnecessary force, scare people half to death. Cutting the telephone was was, in my mind, one of the worst things that they did. Because it's all it would have taken was any of the neighbors to have been there, and the whole situation would have been different. But they didn't want witnesses. They didn't want her neighbors there. They didn't want her attorney there. They didn't want the state police there. They didn't want the sheriff there. I mean, even a criminal, you sat there and read the rights to them. You know, they didn't even bother to do that with them. They told them, in effect, that they didn't have any rights. And weren't going to let them get dressed. Bobby told me that he said, well, we're not decent to go in public. And the federal marshal told him they weren't going in public. I mean, anything they could do to make the situation brutal is what they did. They wanted to set an example of these people, and they set an example of them. Only I think they set the wrong example, because I think it's going to do nothing but encourage people to be that much stronger. You're not going to do to me what you did to Barbara and Bobby Hefner. And again, the bottom line was that there wasn't any necessity for any of it. She's not in the way of construction. She's not in the way of the water. They're two harmless people. And they just should have left them the hell alone. They just didn't have the right to do what they did to them. So I understand, and I verified a lot of this from talking to the sheriff's people, that even after they got them to jail, they didn't take the chains and handcuffs off and weren't going to let them make any phone calls. It was only because the sheriff's deputy removed the chains and the handcuff. Barbara told me, did she tell you she was going up the stairs and the chain fell off? And she said, I just stepped out of it. Of course, they put it back on her, but they were terribly frightened. The sheriff told me, you know, when he got there, of course, by this time when the sheriff got there, it was afternoon and had nothing to eat all day. And he had food fixed for them, but of course, Barbara said she was too upset to eat. But he said they were just pathetic. You know, to see the two of them like that in that situation was just pathetic. Then after I had found out everything that I could find out about what happened, I then got on the phone and called Colonel. First, I called another fella, his name that I had. I don't remember it right now. I'd have to look it up. That was in the real estate division. Well, he didn't know anything about it. You know, that same story. Well, I dealt with the Corps long enough that I knew exactly who to get a hold of. So I made him give me Colonel Wilson's home phone number. And Colonel Wilson is in charge of the Huntington District, of the Corps of Engineers. And it's the Huntington District who's in charge of the real estate acquisition. So I called Colonel Wilson. Well, he was well aware of everything that was going on. He just had his facts wrong. But he knew that this was going to happen. He told me that he had instructed them to have a moving company there and that everything was to be taken out but the walls. And he told me that the sheriff's office was overseeing the eviction. The sheriff's office knew absolutely nothing about it. The federal marshal told me that the Corps left it up to the court to decide what to do with Barbara's property, and that at first they were going to put it out in the street. They were just going to take everything out of the house and put it out on the road, which is what they do in the D.C. area, which they have control of. And according to this particular marshal, it was because of him and a few others said, well, you can't do that. Let's, you know, get a moving company and have her stuff put in storage. So you see, you got all kinds of conflicting stories about who did what to whom. And I told Colonel Wilson that all I wanted was a guarantee from him that the house would not be destroyed until all of her belongings were out. Because Barbara's relatives had been told, and the movers later verified to me, that they were told to pack up what they deemed valuable, and there was a Corps employee sitting on a bulldozer ready to destroy the property. And the only thing that kept that house from being destroyed that same evening was the fact that the idiot federal marshal left, the Corps employee left, And the movers were not supposed to be there without the federal marshal being there. And so they left. Otherwise, they would have packed up what they deemed valuable and the house would have been bulldozed that same Tuesday night.
Which federal marshal was it that was overseeing the eviction?
Ron Donnell.
Oh, he was...
Right. The next day, that's kind of disjointed, but I couldn't get Colonel Wilson to positively agree that the house would not be bulldozed until we got the rest of her belongings out. He kept telling me that they had been instructed to remove her belongings. But when, in fact, the court was the one that was overseeing the eviction, the federal court in Elkins, the court supposedly had nothing to do with it. So, at the same time, then I got a hold of people from Bob Wise's office, and then the following morning they began calling the Corps to ensure the same thing. Friends and neighbors came in Tuesday night and tried to get as much out as we could get out ourselves. And the movers had said that they wouldn't move anything that was still connected. So they unplugged the refrigerator, unhooked the hot water tank, the big appliances, so that the movers at least would move them out, and started taking what they could from the outbuildings. But it was just an overwhelming thing to do. Try to get all our stuff moved out before morning. Then the following morning, Wednesday morning, I called Colonel Rothblum, who's the new colonel in Pittsburgh, and apprised him of the situation. He knew nothing about any of it. And I told him I felt, since the Pittsburgh district was overall in charge of this project, that they really ought to know what's going on, and that these tactics just were horrible. He in turn then said he would get back with me. Wilson was to get back with us, and Bob Wise's office did get through to them. In the meantime, my husband went down Wednesday morning to Barbara's house to make sure that the bulldozers weren't going to run until, they got their whatever they had to get from the Corps. And when he got down there, he'd been down there, Channel 5, the television station was there, and he stopped and talked to those people for a bit. And then all of a sudden, two state policemen showed up. They had word that there was some kind of a disturbance. Well, Matt didn't think too much of that, He sat, chatted with the state police for a while. In the meantime, I was home on the telephone to the Corps personnel, and I got a call from Sheriff Hall. He had a report that my husband and Joe Grant, another watershed person, were at Barbara's keeping the movers from packing up her belongings. So not more than 2 minutes later, my husband pulled into the driveway, and I said, "What's going on at Barbara's?" And he said, "Well, nothing. That nobody was down there but Channel 5. And I said, "Well, the sheriff's office got a report that you and Joe Grant were down there keeping the moving company from packing up." And, of course, Sheriff Hall came out to check the situation out. He didn't tell me who had made the complaint. On the record, he didn't tell me. But I'm positive that it was the Corps had called him with this big, wild story about all this stuff that was going on that wasn't going on. So, of course, Sheriff Hall was extremely angry that he had to take time out to drive up there. Colonel Wilson then, in the meantime, called back and said that there was somebody from the federal court was coming over to oversee the moving of Barbara's things, and that the house would not be bulldozed. We had explained to him that the road was horribly muddy and it was just impossible to get trucks up to the house to move stuff out. The moving van was already up there and a dozer, and that we needed some time for things to dry up and whatnot so we could get all her belongings out. He agreed to a reasonable time. I then called John Klein to make sure that he had gotten his orders from Colonel Wilson. Well, he said that he had. They're so often deaf and dumb, you just have to make sure of these things. And then Sheriff Hall then had talked to the federal marshal and arranged for me to be there and some of his deputies and the federal marshal and the moving people to see if we could get some of the things out that Barbara would need right away. I mean, they had no clothing, She didn't have her winter coat. She didn't have her medicine. She didn't have any of her papers. you know, things that she needed to live on in the meantime until she could get another place. She didn't have any of that. And Ralph Hall saw that, that all went smoothly then. And the one federal marshal who had been on on the eviction, Miss Greenaway, came back. And I don't know if you've ever... I spent the day between... I didn't know whether to cry or to throw up. But to go through somebody's personal possessions like that, looking for clothes for her to wear, trying to find her personal papers, that was awful. That was the worst thing I've ever been involved in my life. Just the, you know, you just felt awful. It was just a total lack of it was just an invasion of privacy. Like, you know, you wouldn't even go into a good friend's home, you know, and sit down maybe and wait for them or do anything like that. And here we are, a federal marshal, a sheriff, deputies, and moving company people commenting on this woman's personal belongings. You know, the moving company people would say, well, what do you think? Should we pack this stuff up in the pantry? You know, or what about this pile of newspapers? It doesn't seem like much to me. Should we pack that? Oh, she must have had 20 pairs of shoes there, or she did. I was just sickening. It's just beyond, I can't even explain it, how horrible it made a person feel. But, I mean, if I hadn't done it, then she wouldn't have had anything, you know. Everything would have gone to Shinston, and she wouldn't have had any of her clothing, or, you know. And the things that we picked, of course, weren't, I mean, we had end up getting... The movers did was they went in each room with big boxes, and they just put everything in that room into boxes. There was no order to anything they packed. And they just started putting stuff in big boxes, and that box would be marked living room, you know, or master bedroom or kitchen. So you really didn't know what was in any of the boxes, only that you knew what room that that stuff had come out of. And so it was just a monumental task trying to find their clothes. Well, as it turned out, you know, some of the clothes that were in Barbara's closet weren't the clothes that she was wearing. She had her good stuff stored in a closet in another room, which we didn't get. You know, and it was... Poor Bobby never did find his underwear. We never did get his checks, his personal checks and things like that. We never did find them, wherever they had gotten packed. I did find a file cabinet that I hoped had her personal papers in. All of her bills, everything that was due, you know, all of her monthly bills, the kind of thing she had on the mantle in the living room or she had out on the dining room table. We never found that stuff. So, you know, she has to go through all that business about, you know, getting bills sent to her again. And sure, on the one hand, that you can argue that she knew this was coming. I mean, that's what the Corps kept saying. She knew this was going to happen to her, but she didn't really know that because she never believed that it was going to happen to her. And she wasn't alone, Michael. A lot of our people, until it actually hit. I mean, after 40 years of hearing about this thing, you know, the dam's going to be built, the dam's going to be built. You know, people at first didn't believe it, and even after the construction started, there was always that hope that it would be stopped and they wouldn't have to leave. And so you never, until you're out, you never really do believe it. You know, even if it wasn't this, you know, even if it wasn't Barbara believing it wasn't what God wanted her to do, facing up to the idea that you had to leave your home and everything that you cared about in the world, you know, for a state park, I mean, it's beyond your comprehension. You know, you just can't face up to it. Some people have done better than other people. But one of these days I'm going to sit down and tally up the death count. Because right around Barbara, there were two old fellas who lived in a trailer within a stone's throw of Barbara's place. They were condemned and forced to leave. They didn't live out the year.
What was their name?
George and Teddy Bond.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about them.
George and Teddy, their family were one of the original settlers of the Roanoke area. And George and Teddy Bond were two brothers who lived together. They lived in a small trailer and they had a nice barn there. And they had Jersey milk cows. And I think both of them had served in service, and George had a discharge, a conscientious objector kind of discharge, I think, from the service. But my husband's 38 years old, and he said that George and Teddy seemed like they were old when he was a boy, you know. But they were up in their 70s. George had this long white beard and white hair and blue eyes that just looked like they were shining all the time. And just two of the nicest, most decent old men you can ever imagine. And they milked their cows, and they sold butter and cottage cheese and things like that for extra money, you know, and they raised a big garden and, like, had free gas. And like a whole lot of other people, they got along just great on a little bit because of where we live. So, of course, they were like everybody else and thought that it'd never happen, and they'd never have to leave. And eventually the court condemned the property and told them they had to leave, and they moved into a house in town, I think, near a brother of theirs. But within a year, both George and Teddy were dead. Another story, another lady that lived in the area, Annie Hefner, was 92 years old at the time when the project geared up. And she lived in her house with the help of a lady from the state hospital who was out on a work program that they had. And this lady from the state hospital lived in and cared for Annie. Annie had one son who lived in some state somewhere else, whom she had signed her house over to already, unfortunately. Well, several times the neighbor people had kept, she was old and she was sick, and her only desire was to be allowed to die in her own home. Well, several times